is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Friday, May 15th, 2020. Taylor Schwenk is producing from his home studio in Connecticut. I'm Buster Olney. I'm working from my home studio just north of New York City. Broadcaster Week continues, and today we'll talk with Gary Cohen, the play-by-play man for the Mets, who gives us the backstory of one of baseball's most memorable home runs ever by Bartolo Colon. Before Todd Radom's quiz, we'll examine San Francisco ballparks with someone who knows them, Giants broadcaster Dwayne Kuiper, who also has a hell of a story about a brawl. First, some notes. Bob Watson, two-time All-Star as a player who later became the first black general manager to win a World Series with the Yankees in 1996, has passed away at the age of 74. During his career, Bob Watson also was the person who scored run number 1 million for Major League Baseball. Art Howe, the former infielder and manager for the Astros, Athletics, and Mets, is fighting the coronavirus and has been moved into an intensive care unit. Last night, a lot of his friends were tweeting out asking for prayers and for thoughts for Art Howe. The Cincinnati Reds are laying off less than 25% of their staff, and they're giving pay cuts for others. This in information that was developed by the Associated Press and also the Reds, and made their announcement of this on Thursday. As we learned earlier in the week, the Miami Marlins will temporarily furlough 90 to 100 baseball operations employees beginning on June 1st. Bryce Harper addressed the comments made by Blake Snell that are getting so much attention, and he's got Blake Snell's back. Give a listen.
What did Snell say on his stream earlier? Do you know?
That he said it's not worth it to play with pay cuts, and that he, like, you guys are risking your lives getting, like, obviously getting COVID.
Yeah, I love Sam. That's my guy, bro.
He said if someone gets it, they got to live with that for the rest of their lives.
He ain't lying. He's right.
He's like, I need my, he's like, give me my money or I'm not playing.
Hey, bro, he's speaking the truth, bro. I ain't mad at him. Somebody's got to say it. At least he manned up and said it. Good for him. I love Snell, man. He has a beast, too.
And Baseball Commissioner Rob Manfred was on CNN Thursday night talking about the sport's plans for testing.
One of the things that comes up, and people have been reading about this, it's that the players' union has indicated that it won't agree to this because it's a pay cut. And obviously there are players who are talking about the risk not being worth it. You're going to try and convince them, obviously, that it's safe. But what about just the optics of this overall, Commissioner? I mean, you know, 35 million people have lost their jobs in the country. There's a fight that's going on over money at the MLB. How do you handle the optics of this?
Yeah, I think that whenever there's a discussion about economics, publicly people tend to characterize it as a fight. Me personally, I have great confidence that we'll reach an agreement with the Players Association, both that it's safe to come back to work and work out the economic issues that need to be resolved.
Now, in talking with sources on Friday morning, they still feel like that Major League Baseball and the Players Association have a long way to go before they reach a deal. Now, before we get to Gary, to Todd and Dwayne, I want to tell you about ESPN's hashtag Dear Sports campaign. We love sports. Sports inspire us. They give us hope in ourselves, in the world, and of course, in amazing comebacks. Our love for sports grows every day. Dear Sports is our love letter to sports. My colleague Jessica Mendoza shared her love letter to sports, and we're going to play it for you right now. You can share your Dear Sports letter with us. Call 860-506-6161. That's 860-506-6161, or share a video or text using the hashtag Dear Sports on Twitter or Instagram.
Dear Sports, my first memories are with you. I grew up on your ball fields. As I got older, the strength I have as a woman came from you. I got that confidence. I got that swag. I met my sisters as my teammates. I got to travel the world, see so much through sports. I miss you. I want to be able to see and watch and get that competitiveness, the adrenaline, everything that comes with being a part of sports, calling sports, and watching sports. Please come back soon. Con amor, Jessica.
Todd Radom is the chief executive of our weekly quiz. He's a graphic artist whose work can be seen on ball fields all across America, all around the world. Or you can go to his website, toddradom.com. Todd, how you doing?
I'm doing fine this week, Buster. How are you?
I'm hanging in there. Now, today in our examination of big league ballparks, we'll be digging into Oracle Park, the home of the San Francisco Giants, long known as AT&T Park. But we'll also be talking about the infamous place known as Candlestick Park. And look, nobody knows those places better than Dwayne Kuiper, who played four seasons in Candlestick and has been a Giants broadcaster throughout their stay in their current home. Kipe, thanks for joining us and helping us, you helping out a fellow farmer.
That's exactly right. And we still have the ongoing debate, whether it's Holsteins or Guernseys. And that issue is going to be solved someday by arm wrestling, I'm convinced.
Yeah, here's the thing. The fact that you got the my cow wrong, you said Guernseys instead of jerseys, that tells you how little respect for you have for my jerseys. Okay?
All right, point well taken. You win round one.
Okay.
Oh, my gosh.
Now, before we get going, as I've told you, we need distractions in this time. I heard you tell a story on NBC Sports Bay Area Twitter about a baseball brawl that broke out and it involved your brother. Can you please tell that story again for our listeners? Because that was a classic.
The setting is Busch Stadium in St. Louis. It's the Giants and the Cardinals, who at that point disliked each other a lot. And my brother was playing collegiate summer baseball in Illinois. And he had a day off, and we were playing in St. Louis. So he decided to jump his car and come visit his older brother. Plus, he knew that these trips meant that I was going to take him to the store and buy him some clothes and make him look, dress up a farm kid as best you can, because I was the guy who had the cash. So anyway, he comes into town. I'm playing the Cardinals. Obviously, he's the same size as I am. My uniform fits him. He's 14 years younger than me. And I went into Frank Robinson's office, our manager, and I said, Frank and Glenn, can he sit in our dugout during the game? And Frank was like, yeah, that's not going to be a problem. Just have him put on your other uniform. Just make sure, that he stays in the dugout. I says, all right, no worries. So anyway, the game starts, and it's Mike Kruko against Joaquin Andujar, who totally disliked each other. And in the very first inning, Manny Trillo, who was coming off a broken wrist, Andujar hits him in the wrist. And I knew that was not going to be good, because Mike was going to retaliate. And he hits Andujar as soon as Andujar steps into the batter's box, and there's a fight. And this fight goes on. This fight goes on for quite a while. It was a good one. And we went on the field, and we did whatever we do, and went back into the dugout, and I was sitting next to my brother and really didn't say much other than, you talk about the fight. And fast forward to Mike and I having breakfast the next morning, and we both got the St. Louis Dispatch. And we're both looking at the sports page, and we're both looking at a picture of the brawl taken from the press box, straight down. And on the field, in clear sight, are two number 18s. There's two Kuipers in the pile, me and my little brother. And by that time, he had already left town. There's no cell phones then. So I wanted to choke him. I wanted to say, wait, what were you doing? Which I later said, what were you doing? And he said, well, I think the idea is there can't be anybody in the dugout if there's a fight. So I didn't want to be the only guy sitting in the dugout. I certainly wasn't going to point it out to him, but that's how my little brother got introduced to a baseball brawl in St. Louis. And by the way, the end of the story is how times have changed. The umpires let both Mike Kruko and Joaquin Andujar go back out and pitch. Mike got the win. Andujar got the loss. How about that?
A massive brawl. Benches emptied, and the two pitchers are staying in the game. You're right. Times have absolutely changed. I can't even imagine how that would be on social media, a picture of you and your brother on Twitter in the same fight.
It would be bad. I mean, there would have to be some serious lying going on for me to protect me and him, and certainly Frank. Frank would have been the one that would have gotten in trouble, and that's the one thing you didn't want to do, as you know, is want to be in trouble with that guy. So anyway, it ended up being a great story, but something that probably should never have happened.
Exactly. All right, Oracle Park. What do you remember about the first time you walked into that park?
Mike Krukow and I walked in the park when it was 70 to 80% completed. And we got a tour. And when we got to right field and we stood on top of the wall in right field, we both looked at each other and almost at the same time said, "This is going to be a joke. It is so short down the right field line. This is going to be a joke." It eventually goes out to, 420 something into right center field. Center field was fair. Left center field, not that fair. 385. Left field, about as fair as you can get. But right field was a joke. That was our first impression. And then when the season opened, the very first home game, we still think that it's going to be very unfair for pitchers to right field. Hitters is going to be great. But the thing they did is they protected the short distance by putting that wall 24 feet high. So if you're going to hit home runs, at least you got to hit it high. And then the first game, Kevin Elster, of all people, he hits 3 home runs in the first game. And then we knew we were right. This place is a joke. And as it turned out, we couldn't have been more wrong. Almost impossible to hit home runs to right field, except for one guy. And almost impossible for major league hitters to put up strong home run numbers in the park. We were totally wrong. A lot of things we didn't take into consideration. We didn't take in consideration the fog, the dampness, the wind, how it blows through those open archways, and that knocked the ball down. So there are a lot of things that all of a sudden made right field very fair. So that's a long-winded first impression.
Todd, what was your first impression, you as an artist?
Yeah, I mean, guys, I think about the fact that 20 years on, they nailed it. I mean, they got this thing right. The first time I visited there was actually for the 2002 World Series, so it's a little bit of a different event. But then as now, I feel like the scale of the park and its materials, they really blend in seamlessly with these very unique surroundings. Every week, Kipe, we talk about a different ballpark, and I keep bringing this up. The best ones have a very defined sense of place. There is no better defined sense of place to me than Oracle Park.
Yeah, and then you know what? You throw in the aspect of a left-handed hitter could hit one in the water. A ball could actually end up in the water on the fly. I mean, we have, from the very first day, we have one camera that sits very high in the upper deck down the right field line, and his only job is to watch balls land in the water on home runs hit by left. I can say right-handed hitters, but nobody's ever done it right-handed.
Right.
So, I mean, that's the beauty of the splash home run is there's a camera for it. And, when Bonds was knocking them in the water, I mean, he did it 37 times. That shot had to be right on 37 times.
Yeah, I do. I love the fact that there's probably more ways to get to this ballpark than any other in baseball. To your point, you could take a kayak there. You could take a ferry. You could take light rail. You could go by car. You can go on foot. It's really unique. as far as that is concerned. And certainly the views of the Bay and the Bay Bridge, the smell and the sights there are just really, really very, very singular.
Yeah, it's pretty unique. But Kipe, as we got ready for this, I was thinking to myself, you know, how did you piss off the baseball gods that the two home ballparks that you played in were Municipal Stadium in Cleveland and Candlestick? What was your worst Candlestick memory?
You know, I had only driven by Candlestick when I was with the Indians. I forget one time we landed in San Francisco to play the A's instead of Oakland, and we were sitting on a bus and somebody said, "Hey, there's Candlestick." And I was like, "That's Candlestick?" He said, "Yeah." So that was the first time I ever saw it. The first time I walked into Candlestick, it was kind of like how the officials saw it for the first time when they decided to choose that piece of land. I walked in, it was calm, it was sunny. It was also, you know, 11:30 in the morning. So I didn't really get a full taste of it until the first night game. And then I was literally, no pun intended, blown away. And the first thing I remember thinking is, this game that we play is so hard. It's so hard to finally get to the major leagues. And then it's hard to play against the best players in the major leagues. And then on top of that, you put us in a place where it makes the game even harder. That's not fair. You know, you got pop-ups, you got the wind that dries out the infield, you got bad hops, you got unfairness to left field for a right-handed hitter. I mean, Willie Mays decided he was just going to go the opposite way. And then, because he was watching the Cubs go, whoop, whoop, whoop. And he's thinking, well, I got to do that to right field. So he started hitting the ball to right field. It just made the game harder. And you know, God bless the players that were successful there. And the Giants had a lot of them because there are days where it just wasn't fun. And as a major leaguer, it should be fun every day. But that place sometimes made it not fun.
Todd, what do you got at Candlestick?
I went to one game there at Candlestick, guys. It was in May 1992, and it was in the days following a curfew in the city of San Francisco and in many places in California after the Rodney King rioting. So I remember going to a game there after having been cooped up in a hotel for a couple of days. It was a turn-back-the-clock game against the Phillies. So you've got this pomp and pageantry and old cars and antique uniforms. So the game starts at 1. It featured a bench-clearing brawl between these two teams. And, well, the wind started swirling around somewhere in the middle of the game. And by the end of the game, the temperature had plummeted without exaggeration, 20, 25 degrees. So I feel like my one experience there, I kind of saw a little bit of everything. It was incredibly memorable.
Exactly what Kipe lived. Kipe, I'm going to have you step in. I've lost the last two quizzes. I'm going to have you step in this week. Todd, why don't you do the quiz with Taylor and Kipe going at it?
All right. We've got an ABCD here, Kipe. So here we go. And I have a Giants question because, of course, the Giants, under manager John McGraw, introduced this uniform innovation to Major League Baseball. Were they the first MLB club to A, wear pinstriped uniforms, to B, decorate their belt loops, to C, wear numbers on the fronts of their jerseys, or D, wear collarless uniforms? Innovation. Were they the first to wear pinstripes, decorate their belt loops, wear numbers on the fronts of their jerseys, or wear collarless uniforms?
Kipe, you've got honors.
What year?
I was under John McGraw, so it was before your time.
You know what? I might go with D.
Okay, Taylor, what you got?
Well, I'm going to make everyone sick on here. I have no idea who John McGraw is.
Taylor!
Definitely, I don't think it's pinstripes. I'm going to lean D with Kipe as well. It's a little bit of a cop-out, but I'm going collarless uniforms.
One was an educated guess. One was a lucky stab. You're both right. In 1906, yes, the Giants introduced the first collarless uniforms, and I will have everyone know that they read World's Champions across the front, celebrating their 1905 World Series title. Audacious.
Wow.
And innovative.
There you go, Kipe.
And who brought them back?
The world champion part?
No, the collar part.
It was pretty much it became this very comfortable, good thing, and everybody eventually took them on within about 10 years.
Bill Veeck brought the collar uniform back with the White Sox.
Oh, the big collars you're talking about. Yes.
Yeah.
They
were ugly.
And we won't even talk about the shorts. You're blessed with better uniforms than those, thankfully.
All right. Well, Kipe, I appreciate it.
Hey, jerseys, right?
Jerseys, not Guernseys. Get it right the next time.
No brawls. Right. No East Coast, West Coast.
I'm 0 for 1.
Thanks, Kipe. Right, thanks, Todd.
All right, guys.
Follow the rules. See ya.
Gary Cohn does play-by-play on Mets games for SNY. He is the point guard for what is considered to be one of the best broadcast booths in baseball history with Ron Darling and Keith Hernandez. Gary, thanks for doing this. Thanks for distracting us a little bit. How are you doing? And the three of you, how much are you keeping up during this downtime?
Oh, I'm doing fine. I mean, this feels, from a personal standpoint, like an extended off-season. Of course, you know, the world is in turmoil, and that's everybody's main concern. But, you know, we're doing a little bit of work here and there. We've done a couple of play-by-play efforts on simulated games, which was a fascinating enterprise. We do a Facebook live chat every week on Thursday afternoons. We've done some writing for the SNY website. So we're trying to stay as busy as we can and provide some content and just kind of tread some water until we're ready to play baseball again.
What are the simulated games like? I know you got attention because you mentioned the Houston Astros at one point.
Well, you know, it's a fascinating thing. I mean, I'm not a video game guy. You know, my kids have played over the years, but I never really participated in any of it. And, well, the first thing is that we're using MLB The Show, and the verisimilitude is unbelievable. I mean, it's amazing how much realism there is in there, to the point where there are times when you're doing the play-by-play of the simulation that you almost forget that you're not watching real people play. And then something weird and quirky happens and you're kind of snap back to reality. But, you know, the games go a lot faster pace. They eliminate a lot of downtime between pitches. So if we could play actual Major League Baseball games at the pace of the computer games, I'd be all in favor of that.
So I want to dig into some memories with you of big moments, big personalities. You got a lot of attention for this great home run call that you had a few years ago. Give a listen to this.
Cologne looking for his first hit of the year. Oh. He drives one deep left field. That goes Upton back near the wall. It's out of here. Bartolo has done it. The impossible has happened. The team vacates the dugout as Bartolo takes the long trot, his first career home run, and there will be nobody in the dugout to greet him. This is one of the great moments in the history of baseball. Bartolo Colon has gone deep. I want to say that was one of the
So, Gary, what do you remember about that?
Well, there's so much to it, right? I mean, first of all, you know, over the years, you come up against a lot of moments, right? And you never script a call, but there are certain moments that you can't anticipate, right? The team's going to clinch a pennant, a player's approaching an important record, late innings of a close game when you're waiting for that defining play in a game. All those things you're kind of ready for. But the most fun things in baseball are the things that you can't possibly anticipate. And this one certainly falls into that category. But so much of it had to do with the backstory. I mean, here was Bartolo Colon at age 42, a differently shaped player from most of what Major League Baseball has to offer. His unflappable nature, the ups and downs of his career. So he became a beloved figure to Mets fans, not the least of which was the fact that his at-bats had become so entertaining. mostly in a negative sense, right? Flailing at the ball, losing his helmet, spinning around, sometimes going up there and just taking three strikes. Every at-bat for Cologne was an event, and this was his third season as a Met. Now, his first year, he had only gotten a couple of hits, but he'd really worked hard at it, and his second season, he had 8 hits. And so this was his third year, and he had gotten incrementally better, but there was no way on earth that you could ever anticipate him hitting a home run. And, you know, as it turned out, he was the oldest player ever to hit his major league home run. And also add in the fact that the game was in San Diego, and there was a cadre of about 1,000 or 1,500 Met fans. You can hear the cheering in the background there. Normally when a road player does something extraordinary, you don't hear that kind of reaction. But because this group of Mets fans had traveled to the game, you had that as well. So much went into that reaction and the shock value and the, you know, the whole way that Ron Darling and I reacted to the home run. You can hear Ronnie chuckling in the background through most of it. It was a singular event for a singular guy, and I think that's why we reacted the way we did.
And it was so great because you guys had so much fun with it. One of the great things about the work that you do is you go into the clubhouse every day. Like you, as you know, there's some broadcasters who won't do that. They kind of keep away from the clubhouse, but you go in there just about every day. And I'm curious about if you remember seeing him after that for the first time, because I'm guessing you may have said something to him.
You know, Bart was a unique figure in that he, how do I put this? Bart speaks English about as well as you and I do, but he's reluctant to do a lot of that publicly. So, you know, we had short chats, but we didn't have a lot of intimate conversations, I have to say. But he was a beloved figure in that clubhouse. He kept everybody loose. He was so unflappable, and all the players gravitated to him. So to me, that's more of what his clubhouse presence was all about. It was just about how he interacted with his much younger teammates and how much they looked up to him. And you could see from the reaction of his teammates when he hit the home run just how beloved he was.
What do you remember from 2015, the night that Wilmer Flores reportedly was going to be in a trade away from the Mets and he began to weep on the field? Because that certainly was something that we hadn't seen before.
Well, it was different, and I think it had to do with the times and the way social media had really taken hold. I mean, we're doing the game and we're looking at Twitter and seeing every reputable national baseball reporter in the country reporting that this deal is done and that Wilmer's been traded to Milwaukee for Carlos Gomez. And because we knew it, so did the fans in the stands, because they had access to that same reporting. The only people who didn't know it were the people in the dugout. Terry Collins was not aware. Wilmer Flores was not aware. And so he kept going back in the game every inning during this time period when we all thought that the deal was done. So then at some point he becomes aware of it from a fan. And now here's a kid, 24 years old. He spent 8 years in this organization, signed at the age of 16, never had known any other organization. And he's starting to cry on the field. And finally, you know, Terry becomes aware of what's going on and he takes him out of the game. But that moment cemented Wilmer Flores's status with the fan base in a way that I've never seen before or since. You know, fans spend their entire lives rooting for a particular franchise. Players come and go, and they come and go among organizations too. Fans have great passion for that uniform and that culture. And to see a player feel as they do about being a part of that organization and do so humanly, I think really bonded Wilmer to Mets fans in a way that was not possible in any other circumstance. And you could see it the next time he played on that that Friday night against the Nationals when he got a standing ovation every time he came to the plate, and he winds up hitting the game-winning home run in the 12th inning, which just added a poetic close to that game. And really, for every moment after that, Wilmer became a popular player in a way that I had never seen before.
Yeah, he'll be a guy when he's 65, 70 years old. They'll bring him back to throw out a first pitch, and he'll get one of the biggest cheers among Mets fans, because that is a legendary story. Johan Santana, 134 pitch no hitter. What do you remember?
Well, I mean, for people who don't know the history, you know, the Mets had some of the greatest pitchers in the history of the game pitch for their franchise, led by Tom Seaver, but, you know, also Dwight Gooden and David Cohn and Ron Darling and so many others. And for a franchise that had been known throughout a half a century for its pitching, somehow quirkily, they had never had a no-hitter, and it almost became a part of the DNA of the franchise that all these pitchers, some of whom threw no-hitters before they became Mets, some of whom threw no-hitters after they left, none of them had ever thrown one for the Mets. And this seemed like the most unlikely night for it to happen. Remember, Santana had capsule surgery in his shoulder. They were going very slowly with him in terms of his pitch count. In fact, Terry Collins had said before the game that he was going to throw 105 or 110 pitches. And in this game against the Cardinals in 2012, he walked four batters in the first five innings. So his pitch count was getting up there. So there was a point in the fifth or sixth inning, even though he had a no-hitter intact, that we're starting to talk about the fact that there's just no way he's going to be able to go nine innings because of the number of pitches he's throwing. Then Mike Baxter makes a great play in the field, and there's a controversial call on a fair foul on a ball hit by Carlos Beltran. And now you're starting to think, well, we're getting deeper into this game. And you could see pitch by pitch the agony that Terry Collins was going through, because he understood what was going on, that as long as Johan didn't allow a hit, he was going to have to make the decision, okay, do I leave him in there? Do I take him out? He's throwing far more pitches than we know is good for his arm. And that became part of the dynamic. And then Johan started to kick it into gear, and he's pitching better and better, and he found his changeup. And I have to tell you, as somebody who has, you know, not only been a Mets broadcaster for many years, but has been a Mets fan from the time he was 6 years old and has seen most of the games that this franchise has competed in, I was convinced as that observer that it was never going to happen, that the Mets would never have a no-hitter. And you get to two out in the ninth inning, and Johan falls behind David Freese 3-0. And now you're thinking, oh, gosh, he's at 131 pitches. He's 3-0 on Freese. If he walks him, now what happens? And he comes back and strikes him out. But it wasn't until Freese swung and missed at that last changeup that I ever thought it was even possible that it would happen. And I'm just glad, you know, no hitters are quirky things, right? I mean, all sorts of no names and journeymen have thrown no hitters over the course of baseball history. I'm just glad that when the Mets finally got a no hitter, it was a guy of the stature of Johan Santana, who was, you know, one of the elite pitchers of his generation, that he was the guy who finally did it.
And you're right about how Terry Collins was tortured. I've known him since 1989, and he wears his emotions on his sleeve. And watching that game and sort of him physically reacting to what was going on, you as a Mets fan, did he make the right decision? Because I remember talking to Terry, maybe it was a couple days after that, and he was, on one hand, apologetic, and on the other hand, he was like, I have to leave him in. Like, how can I take him out of that game? How did you feel?
I think that if you asked Terry today, he would still express regret about leaving him in the game. Now, if what happened afterward, Johan actually pitched a couple of terrific games later that month. I think he threw 8 scoreless innings against the Dodgers, if I'm not mistaken. But then once the calendar turned to July, things started to fall apart for him, and really he was never the same after that. Now, you want to make the argument that the 134 pitches contributed to the downfall of his career? I don't know. None of us knows enough about pitching physiology to know that for sure. I will tell you this, though, that I don't think Johan has a single regret. I think that if he had to do it all over again, that he would have stayed in and thrown those 134 pitches to try to get that no-hitter, because it meant a lot to him.
Same thing happened with David Cone, 1999. You know, they had a rain delay when he was pitching for the Yankees against the Montreal Expos. He was warming up in the runway outside of the Yankees clubhouse to get ready. Then he comes back out and he throws a perfect game. And it was soon after that, pretty much straight downhill. But that's something that's always been meaningful to him.
I saw David Cone throw 166 pitches in a game when he was with the Mets. I think it was Buddy Harrelson was the manager at the time. And there was such a backlash to that, that the Mets for several years after that stopped announcing pitch counts in the press box.
Pete Alonso's emergence last year was unlike anything that I've ever seen. You've been around him. Take us through some of what you saw.
Well, it's an extraordinary thing. I mean, you know, we knew that Pete Alonso was a big power hitting prospect. And if you remember, he did not get called up in September in 2018, which I think surprised a lot of people because he had an extraordinary year. But what we kept hearing from the reports from the minor leagues was that he was such a defensive liability that they were fearful that someone was going to get hurt, maybe him, if they ever put him at first base in a big league game. So there was that. Then there was the controversy in spring training last year as to whether he would actually start the season with the Mets. We had an extraordinary spring training. It was clear that he deserved to make the team and he was going to be a big part of it. But, you know, with service time issues and, you know, you go back to the Chris Bryant situation with the Cubs a few years earlier, there was every chance that he would be left behind. But Brody Van Wagenen, to his credit, said if he deserves to make the team, he'll be there. And he was from opening day. And from the day the season started, first of all, he turned out to be much less of a defensive liability than we thought. Second of all, he was every bit the power threat that we thought. But the piece that I don't think anybody could have imagined was that within 2 months after the start of last season, this rookie, who had not spent a day in the major leagues before 2019, became the face and voice of the franchise. Now, I've been around for a long time, and when I first started 30-some years ago, there was no way, no matter how successful, that any rookie could have taken on a leadership role the way Pete Alonso did. It just wouldn't have been allowed in a big league clubhouse. But things have evolved in the game to the point where younger players are taking more prominent roles earlier on in their careers, not just on the field, but off as well. And Pete, in very short order, became one of the leaders in that clubhouse, to the point where at this, you know, very early stage in his career, just a year in, people are already talking about him as the next David Wright, the next captain of the Mets. And that's an extraordinary thing. I mean, the 53 home runs will be indelible, and who knows how long that record may last. It might depend on the composition of the baseball in years to come. But the way that Pete Alonso has taken the city and that clubhouse into his own hands, and just he's been a remarkably human voice for this team, and it's been an extraordinary thing to watch. He's a fantastic kid, and I'm very much looking forward to seeing what the next act is.
Yeah, we talked about the emotion with Wilbur Flores when you saw the reaction from Pete last year when he broke the record from Aaron Judge on the field. What was going through your mind? Because I you know, what I always think of when I talk to friends and they ask me about him, I say the word that applies to him more than any other is the word earnest. Like, that to me just describes him.
He is. He's genuine. And you know, so many things that he did last year, taking charge of getting special cleats made for his teammates for the game on 9/11. So many community projects that he has spearheaded, always seems to have the right word for the right time. He's just, you know, I mean, look at his reaction when he won the home run derby. I mean, it was, you know, you were there. He's just a remarkable kid. And, you know, I'm just so happy for him.
All right, let's do a little round of rapid fire before you go. Throw a name at you or a moment. Jacob DeGrom.
Well, he's just the best. As competitive a human being as I've ever seen. He was a remarkable story from the day he arrived in the big leagues. He wasn't even supposed to be starting for the Mets. He was a guy who kind of came out of nowhere, but this guy is as competitive a human being as I've ever seen, and all he's done is get better over his 6 years in the big leagues. I can't imagine what's to come. And, you know, the only shame of it is that he started so late. He's going to be 32 this year, and he's got two Cy Youngs under his belt, and who knows how many more he can put together before he's done.
Matt Harvey.
He was a meteor, man. He shone as brightly as anybody, and then he crashed to earth. His stretch from when he came up in 2012 through 2013, when he started the All-Star game and through that year, was as dominant as anybody I've ever seen. And then to go down with Tommy John and to come back and throw more innings than any pitcher coming back from Tommy John had ever thrown in his first year back, culminating in that World Series game five and begging for the ball in the ninth inning. He was extraordinary, but between injury and some self-inflicted wounds, I don't know whether his career is over or merely derailed, but nobody ever starred as quickly and crashed as quickly as Matt Harvey did.
And last one, because you work in New York, you get a lot of celebrities that come through City Field and also through your booth. Give me a name drop story about a celebrity who walked in and you were like, wow.
Well, I mean, we've been very fortunate to have Jerry Seinfeld in our booth on a number of occasions. So that's a special treat. And of course, you know, Keith Hernandez has his own relationship with Jerry, having starred in his own episode of Seinfeld. And, you know, Keith gets asked about Seinfeld at least as often as he gets asked about his baseball or broadcasting careers. But Jerry's been a great, great friend to us. And it's always a special day when we have him around.
All right, Gary. Well, I appreciate your time on this. Thank you for helping to distract us.
Thanks very much, Buster. You stay well.
Bleacher Tweets.
All righty, Buster. Bleacher Tweets for Friday. First up, we got Ryan Mayer, rmayer151 on Twitter, writes in, does the current situation kill Mookie Betts' chance of a $400 million contract? Seems like the market will shift a little bit after this. What do you think?
Yeah, no doubt, Ryan. It's coming down. It's hard to know for sure. We have to wait for the sort of dust to settle from what happens this summer before we know exactly the context in which he's going to step into free agency. But just talking with officials around baseball, they do think that a lot of payrolls are going to be pulled back dramatically.
Bob Mikowski writes in at Bob Mikowski 1. Who's one living person that you've never met or spoken to that you would love to interview on the podcast?
President George W. Bush, because his family has been so rooted in baseball. His dad, President H.W. Bush, he loved baseball. You'd see him at Astros games. He played when he was in college. Supposedly, he was a really great defensive player. President George W. Bush was the owner of the Texas Rangers. He's friends with Tim Kirkchin. I'd love to hear those stories. And he threw out the first pitch during the 2001 World Series that we all remember. And I'd love to talk to Cal Ripken. You know, I covered him for 2 years with the Baltimore Sun. You know, that was a time there was a lot of scrutiny on Cal. He had a lot of tension on him. I was a new B writer there. We didn't have the best relationship. I've always said to people that my great regret in the 2 years that I covered Cal, that I didn't mine the baseball information that he has, which is enormous.
Interesting. Last one up for the week. Cinegrades at Cinegrades writes in, hey, Buster, it has been so fun growing up by the Mud Hens. A minor leaguer I got to see develop was Curtis Granderson. I will not do the pronunciation he throws out there in his tweet, but he asks, who was a minor league player who you remember enjoying following before they were famous?
I'll do the announcement because I think it falls right in line with a minor league player who was named Razor Shines. And when he was introduced at the ballpark in Indianapolis, it was Razor Shines.
Nice.
And that's going to Curtis Granderson, I'm sure, is part of how they did that one. For me, and I think because I covered him in the minor leagues, it was really cool, was Skeeter Barnes, who I covered for 2 years. He was a great guy. Played him in wiffle ball. Did pretty well against him, by the way. And after I left Nashville, he wound up having like 5 years in the big leagues. And I was so happy for him that after a lot of years in the minor leagues, he actually stayed in the big leagues for a time with the Detroit Tigers playing for Sparky Anderson.
You knew him before he was big. Thanks for the tweets, everyone. Subscribe, rate, and review to the podcast wherever you get your podcast. And if you were just listening to this on a Saturday or Sunday, thanks for doing the weekend listening bit. A lot of people are doing that. So if you have to catch up, you know, while you're going on your weekend drive, perfect time to roll through some episodes of Baseball Tonight.
That's it for today. That's it for this week. My thanks today to Gary and to Kipe and to Todd and to Taylor. Have a great weekend, everybody. Thanks for listening and stay safe.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.